Hey y'all, this is Connie Morgan with the Free Black Thought Podcast. Today's guest is Pastor Corey Brooks, though you may know him as the Rooftop Pastor. Pastor Brooks is committed to eradicating violence and transforming lives in Chicago's South Side. He is the founder and senior pastor of New Beginnings Church of Chicago and the CEO of Project Hood, Communities Development Corporation. In a daring act of advocacy, Pastor Brooks first spent 93 nights and then later 343 nights on the rooftop of a dilapidated motel across from his church and later camping out on a makeshift roof across the street from New Beginnings Church in order to raise over $20 million for a community center in the O neighborhood he pastors in. We also touch on his theological background and things to look for in a solid pastor. Pastor Brooks doesn't just talk the talk, he walks the walk, because remember, there's no such thing as a black perspective, just black people with perspectives. Pastor Corey Brooks, thank you so much for joining me here today on the Free Black Thought Podcast. We are big fans over at FBT, and we have had you on our short list of podcast guests for a long time. So glad to be finally making this happen. And you're doing so many amazing things that we're going to talk about. But first, let's just give us your origin story. Give us that autobiography. Where did you grow up? How did little Corey Brooks become Pastor Corey Brooks?
Absolutely. Well, first, let me say thank you for having me on. I greatly appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you and your followers and listeners. So thank you. I was born in a little town called Union City, Tennessee. And from 1 year old to about 10 years old, I grew up in a little town called Kenton, Tennessee, population of about 1,300 people. It's a little bitty small town. Most of the black people who lived there were all relatives. So it's close knit with lots of uncles and aunts and cousins all over the place, little farm town. And my mom eventually got remarried and moved to Muncie, Indiana, which is pretty much where I grew up as a teenager. Went to high school there, Muncie Central High School, played sports. I went to Ball State University, which is also in Muncie, Indiana. That's also where I started preaching. And then from there, I graduated from Ball State University, went to law school for a year at the University of Florida. And then I decided I should not be in law school. I need to be in seminary. Mm-hmm. So I left and went to Dallas Theological Seminary. And from there, I got called to pastor a little church in Richmond, Indiana. I was 22 years old, pastoring my first church, stayed there for 4 years before going to being called to another church in Chicago, West Point Baptist Church, stayed there 4 years and decided I wanted to do something different. I wanted to start a church that was contemporary, creative, incredible, really focused on people in the community. And so we left there and we started where we are now, New Beginnings Church of Chicago. And out of that was born our non-for-profit Project Hood. Hood stands for Helping Others Obtain Destiny. And that's where we are to this day on 66 and King Drive in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago in Woodlawn on a block called O Block.
So let's go back a little bit. I want to ask a couple questions about your upbringing. So your mother remarried. Was your biological father a part of your life or was he not?
He was not. So I said remarried, and I should have just said married because she never was married.
Okay.
My mom was a teenage mother, and she had me when she was 19. My father, my biological father, pretty much was never in my life. And then once my mom got married and moved to Muncie, Indiana, after a couple of years of living with my grandparents, I moved with her and my stepdad. And that's why I grew up in Muncie, Indiana.
Okay. And then were you raised in the church or did you come to faith on your own later?
Yeah, I was raised in the church. You know, when you're in a little town like Kenton, Tennessee, everybody goes to church. It's just part of the experience. And so from there, when I got to Muncie, Indiana, my mom was still faithful in church. And she always made me go to church, even though I was a pretty rebellious teenager and I rebelled against all forms of Christianity and church experiences. But she would make sure that no matter what you did on Friday and Saturday, on Sunday, you're going to get your behind up and you are going to church. And not only are you going to go to church, but you're going to go to afternoon service. You're going to go to evening service. It was a whole day experience. So church was something that I had to do.
So if you were rebellious as a young teen, as a young man, but you also started preaching pretty young. So when did that shift happen?
You know, I started around about, you know, at 14, I knew I was called to preach. I knew that I felt a calling on my life to be a preacher. But I tell everybody, I despised preachers. I did not like preachers and I did not want to be a preacher. That was the last thing I wanted to do. And so I just basically would try to do any and everything to like get rid of that feeling of, you know, I know I'm called to preach. So if it was a party to kick it, I was going to be there. If it was anything else going on to get rid of those feelings, I was going to be doing it. And so between 14 and 19, when I finally yielded and said, okay, I'm gonna do what I think God is calling me to do. Those years were very tumultuous. They were very, very tough.
Has your theology pretty much stayed the same throughout, or have you had changes in how you actually approach scripture?
That's a great question. I think my theology was kind of formed at Dallas Theological. So once my theology was formed and once I started learning how to study theology, I think, you know, when I first started preaching, you know, here I am 19 years old. I'm in Muncie, Indiana, and I haven't taken any theology classes, haven't taken any biblical classes. I'm just being mentored by my pastor, who was a great guy, who really loved the Lord, who really loved scripture and had an appreciation for the word. But I hadn't really studied in-depth theology. So when I got to Dallas Theological and started taking classes and found out, oh, okay, this is how you exegete a scripture. This is how you formulate theology. This is how you have different beliefs. Once I learned that, that was pretty much how my theology started to formulate.
Okay, yeah. I really appreciate that you went to seminary school too, because I think it was, we had Kendall Qualls, his episode just published this week that we're recording this, and he talked about how Vodi Bakum makes the point that like 70% or something of Black pastors have never been to seminary school, which I didn't know that. And so do you find that when you're interacting, I'm kind of assuming, and maybe this is a bad assumption, but I'm assuming you have a network of pastors and stuff that you're working with in the area that you're in and the type of guy you are, they're probably frequently Black pastors. Do you find that that's true? Like a lot of them have never been to seminary and they don't have the ability to kind of exegete the way that somebody who has been to school can.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that is a truth, that 70% of Black pastors have not been to school to get theology training, which leads to a lot of doctrinal issues. It leads to a lot of problems. It leads to a lot of misinformation. And I believe oftentimes it leads to our people being more excited than enlightened. Mm. And so that's a big problem. And I think there's a difference between, you know, there are some pastors who haven't been to college. I mean, haven't been to seminary, but they committed themselves to studying the word and they kind of have learned on their own. You do have those, but for the most part, when individuals don't go to seminary, I can tell.
See, I didn't even know. I thought, why would a church even hire you to be their pastor without having that? But I guess they're going off and maybe planting their own churches or something. How does that even happen?
Yeah, you got it. You know, the pandemic made a lot more things more apparent than we probably have not been noticing. The pandemic, you got the opportunity to see individuals who were on the internet who started their own churches, started their own ministries. A lot of pop-up ministries started during those times because people had social media platforms, and you had guys on social media platforms with very large followings with no training, not just seminary training, but no training from having a pastor and a mentor to help oversee them and instruct them and guide them. And those are apparent as well. But there are a lot of young men and sisters who have started pastoring churches and starting churches without being trained. And we have a lot of that in our community. And I think that's, you know, unfortunately, I think that's one of the problems that we have with the Black church, so to speak. And I say that in quotes, the Black church, is that we have a lot of individuals who are not trained.
Is there any change in the tide? Are folks like you, you know, wrapping your arms around these younger folks that want to be pastors and say, you got to go to school? Do you think there's a shift coming?
Yeah, for the worse.
Oh, dang it.
yeah, no. I think I was talking to a pastor friend of mine, and I was saying, man, it's kind of ironic that, I mean, it's kind of funny that when we were growing up, guys were announcing their calling to preach and accepting a call to ministry, and they saw that as not just an opportunity to preach, but an also opportunity to prepare, which meant go to seminary, go to school. In this day and time, there are so many individuals who are just starting ministries and starting their own platforms without any type of training, and they don't see the need for training. And sometimes it comes across as if they're turned off by individuals who are trained. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we're right in line with scripture and the day and the times in which we live. There's definitely a great falling away from sound doctrine.
And obviously people should be in the word themselves. I mean, you should be able to, if you're a Christian or you're exploring Christianity or whatever, sure, you should be in the word yourself. And that's how you can help yourself distinguish who the real ones are, who the trained folks are, who the people are who know what they're talking about. But just, do you have any kind of words of wisdom or guidelines that people should be looking for as kind of red flags if you're starting to follow either an online or in-person pastor or whatever? Of course, you can, if you're in person, you could probably just go ask them, have you been to seminary? But what are some things where you go, oh, pump the brakes when you see this coming out of a church or someone who professes to be a preacher or pastor?
Another great question. One is, I want to know, what is your biblical background? You know, did you go get training? Did you go to school? That, for me, that's really important. Two, I want to know, who are you submitted under? Like, who's your pastor? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm leery of pastors who don't have pastors. I'm leery of guys and individuals who they don't have anyone that they're submitted to. And because oftentimes you can look at a pastor's pastor and say, okay, they at least come from a good stock. They at least come from somebody who's trying to train them and develop them. And when they just pop up on the scene and they don't have anyone that they're submitted to or anyone that can call them and correct them, and they don't have any accountability, they're just out there, that's a pass. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then the third thing is, you know, if they're not in the word, you know, I don't care how charismatic, there are a lot of charismatic individuals who are really charismatically gifted, but if they're not in the word, if they're not teaching solid principles and staying solid on what the word says, then that's another red flag as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So when you were young and you were fighting the calling, part of that was probably going to law school. You were still sort of like, well, this might be something I do on the side. This might be something, you know, that just kind of fills the empty space. I'm going to go to law school. What did your family say when you actually kind of succumbed to that calling and dropped out of law school? I have a feeling they were probably disappointed. They're probably really pumped that you were going to be a lawyer.
No, actually it's kind of the other way around. Wow. My mom was really excited. She was always saying, you know, when I announced my calling to preach, she was always promoting, you ought to go to get training, go to seminary. So when I went to law school, she was kind of disappointed.
Really?
So I went to law school because I always wanted to be a lawyer since I was a little kid. So I just thought I could do both. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll be a lawyer and be a preacher. I never intended to really be a pastor. So that wasn't in the forefront of my mind. But when I said, I need to leave law school, she said I was going to Dallas to theology. She didn't know anything about theology school or know anything about Dallas, but just the fact that I was going to study the Bible, she was super excited about that.
Okay. Well, that's very refreshing to hear. I think a lot of people, especially if you come from that kind of like single mom background, like they're pumped if you're going to med school, law school, you know, yeah. one of those. So that's actually really refreshing to hear. You kind of just made a subtle distinction. You said that you wanted to be you were going to preach, but you weren't going to be a pastor. You didn't think you were going to be a pastor. What's the difference?
So, you know, all pastors can preach, but not all preachers are pastors. At least we hope they can preach.
Yeah.
So preachers are individuals who minister and teach the word of God, but they don't necessarily oversee churches. Mm-hmm. Pastors are individuals who oversee churches, and they also teach and preach the word of God as well. So that is the distinction. The pastor is an overseer. A preacher is more or less just can be a teacher or an assistant, but they don't oversee the church.
So if someone thinks they're going to be a preacher, but not a pastor, what they're thinking is I'll be a guest in the pulpit at various churches. I might write books. I might have a YouTube or something like that. That's
yes.
more what the preaching only role.
Exactly.
Would be. Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to be a teacher. I might be a traveling evangelist, so to speak, or a guest speaker at other places, but I'm not going to be a pastor. That's, yeah.
Okay.
There are those individuals who think like that as well.
Okay. And to me, it just seems like if you're going to preach and you want to be a teacher, it seems like you would be driven to lead a church or be an associate pastor or something like that. Why would somebody not, because of like you wanted to pursue a law career as well? Is that the type of person that's kind of doing like, I don't want to be a pastor, but I only want to be a preacher? It seems like it would be rare to find someone that wouldn't want to be pastoring a church if they also have a heart for teaching.
No, there's a lot of individuals who are preachers, but don't want to really be pastors. You know, sometimes the individuals just want to be on staff, Christian education departments.
Right. Okay. So still linked to a church, pastors. But not.
Yeah. They're
okay.
still linked. Yeah. It's not over. They just don't want to be the main individual, the pastor.
Right, right. Okay, yeah. Okay. And one thing that you haven't touched on is your personal family. Are you married? Do you have kids? What's that story?
I'm married to the Delilah. Her name is Delilah, and we have four kids. We have two girls and two boys. So it's a girl, boy, girl, boy. And we have two grandkids, a girl and a boy. Well, a boy and a girl. So we have a really blessed family. All of my kids are adults. And so, the last one is in his last year of school as far as college is concerned, but, we have a wonderful family.
When did you get married in the timeline?
So I would have gotten married. I would have been 23. So I started pastoring at 22, got married at 23, and yeah.
The rest is history. Okay, great.
The rest is history.
So you were kind of going through this big, like, personal shift before. Well, maybe you were dating her, but I'm always kind of curious about when people go through these like personal journeys, when that other their spouse became a part of it, right? Did you kind of get it together and then you pursued a female, or was she with you while you were on this journey?
Yeah, I kind of got it together, and then I met her. Actually, I met her at my friend's wedding. And so my friend was getting married and her friend. Mm-hmm. And I saw her at the wedding and we kind of connected at the wedding. And I was in seminary at that time and we dated, and then I got called a pastor, and then that's when we got married.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. You described, yeah. I think you used the phrase contemporary, creative, incredible. That's the type of church that you wanted to pastor and lead. What does that mean exactly? How do you know whether if a church is those things, contemporary, creative, incredible?
Okay. So contemporary, meaning we wanted it to be relevant. The two churches that I had pastored prior were really, really traditional, hard line traditional churches. And I have nothing against tradition. It just didn't fit what I wanted to do. I wanted to be involved in a church that was really relevant and spoke to the people in the times in which it was in. And so we wanted to be contemporary, up to date. The second thing, we wanted to be credible, which meant that we wanted people to trust our church and believed that our church had a certain level of integrity. We wanted it to be a credible ministry. We didn't want to just be saying one thing about the church and then doing something else. So being credible was really important. And then being creative, we wanted to make sure that we used all the gifts that were available to the church, whether it was the arts and music or dance or we just wanted to be creative in how we did ministry, especially with outreach. We didn't want to just do the traditional stuff of knocking on people's doors and things like that. No, we wanted to do creative things to get people to be a part of our church. So we had block parties. We still have block parties. We would do food distributions, Bible distributions, everything that was creative to win people to Christ.
Does contemporary mean like up to date and contemporary? Is that in the music that you know use for worship? Is that in the art that's on the walls? What the way people dress in the, I don't know, what does that mean exactly?
You hit all of them. It's definitely the music. One of the things that we wanted to make sure is that we were using music that appealed to a certain audience. Most of the people in our church are young people, and they've never belonged to a church. This is their first church, and so we wanted music that was not just traditional gospel, but we wanted contemporary Christian music. We wanted contemporary worship music, and we still do that to this day. We try to we put our own little urban, you know, twist on it, but we make sure that the music is up to date. And as far as dress is concerned, you know, I'm not preaching in suits and things like that. You're not going to find me, you know, preaching in a black suit with a black tie and a traditional Baptist guy. Mm-hmm. I'm just not that way. So even the members of our church, you know, if you decide to come dressed up, that's fine. But if you decide you want to wear some sweats, mm-hmm. that's fine too. Mm-hmm. And so we all of those things are a part of it.
Okay. So we'll transition now into more of the ways that your church is credible and the work, awesome work that you're doing. You have the nickname of the rooftop pastor. Why? Tell us that story.
So they call me the rooftop pastor because there was a hotel across the street from our church. And this hotel was a den of iniquity. It was horrible. They had prostitution, they had drug dealing. The gangs were using it as a place to, as a headquarters. And it was right across the street from our church. And we decided we wanted to do something with it. We wanted to get rid of them. We wanted to change it, change the neighborhood, change that place. And so we were trying to purchase the building. The owner would never sell it to us. And I understand why, because, you know, they were using it for illegal activities. And so I just have become so fed up with it that one day I really sensed the Spirit of the Lord ministering to me about what ought to be done. And so I went up on the top of the roof of the motel. We pitched the tent on top of that roof, and I refused to come down. And I said I was not going to come off that roof until we had enough money to purchase it and tear it down and start trying to build a leadership and economic opportunity center to change the community. And so in 2011, of November 20th, I went up on the top of the roof, and I thought it was going to be like a week or so. People would hear, you know, hey, this is crazy black preacher on the south side of Chicago on a rooftop, and he's refusing to come down until he raises enough money to purchase this building. But it ended up turning into 94 days on top of that roof from November the 20th to February the 24th.
That is cold.
In the winter of Chicago. Oh. And so that is how the name of the rooftop pastor was originated and was born. And then over time it matured because I went up on the roof again for this second phase.
So the first time you stayed up longer than you thought you would, just because you were getting so much. It was such a good fundraiser. It took longer than you thought it would to get the attention that you wanted to get.
It took a lot longer. I thought a week people would hear about it and everybody would give, but it did not happen like that. It was real slow, and people were giving. But I think, you know, in Chicago, you fight against past ideas about pastors and churches. And I think people were trying to really gauge, okay, is this for real? And are they going to really buy this building? Are they going to really do what they say they're going to do? And so it was really kind of hard convincing people. But I think what helped people to be more convinced is the fact that they were like, after a while, okay, he's not coming down. He's serious. And so I think that helped garner the needed attention that we needed to finish getting all the money to purchase it and tear it down.
Okay, so that's what you had, the money you needed after that 94 days.
Yeah, okay. The 94th day, we received all the money, the rest of the money that we needed. And Tyler Perry, matter of fact, gave us the last $100,000 as a gift toward the effort. And we were able to purchase it. And immediately we tore it down.
And where did that number come from? The person who didn't want to sell it to you originally was like, well, if I am going to sell it, I'm going to charge you five times what it's worth or something like that. Where did that number come from?
Well, it actually came from his bank, because we also did another thing too. We basically had him shut down. Our church members and our community protested in front of that motel every Friday and Saturday and Sunday, from sunup to sundown, so that people could not utilize it. So we put him in a financial drain once we found out that he made the most of his monies on Fridays and Saturday nights. Yeah. And so after a while, the bank kind of got involved, and he was strapped for the money. And they were like, hey, and we let him know, we're not gonna back down. It's only gonna get worse. Mm-hmm. So you would be wise to sell it to us.
Yeah. Okay. So then you get the money, you buy it, you tear it down. Had you already started Project Hood at that point, or did that come as an outgrowth of that project to tear down the motel?
Exactly. So while I was on the roof, we were trying to figure out all the problems in the neighborhood. You know, what are causing these issues? Because the gang banging was at an all-time high. A lot of people were being shot and killed. There was a lot of incidents of individuals who were, you know, being destroyed by the violence in our community. And so we start saying, okay, what do we need to do in order to change this block? This block, by the way, was called O Block because it was named after a young man named O.D. Perry who was shot and killed. And the gangs picked up the O in his name and started calling it O Block. The Chicago Sun-Times said in 2014, it was the most dangerous block in all of Chicago. And so we really wanted to change that. We wanted to, you know, I was really taken back because I'm thinking, you know, our church is on this block. And one of the things I remember in a seminary class, a professor saying that has always been a part of my mindset as far as ministry is related, is if your church is in a community and that church was removed from the community, would it make any difference? And so with that being in my mind and with the violence in our community, we wanted to do something. So we came up with an organization called Project Hood. And we made it a separate non-for-profit. Hood stands for Helping Others Obtain Destiny. And we said we're going to design it so that our church will use this as a missionary arm of our church. So we'll do all the outside work, all the missionary work, all the outside things. But it also gave us an opportunity to get more people involved from outside the community who may not be as interested in the church, but they may work with a non-for-profit. So we took that idea, and that's how we formulated Project Hood.
When you and your church kind of disrupted what was going on at this motel, did you then become a target of the gang folks that were involved in all this illegal money-making? Were you harassed?
You know, yeah, we have some confrontations. We had some major confrontations. You know, I can recall several incidents where it was, you know, really scary. But after a while, once we started winning the trust of a lot of the guys in the neighborhood and they realized that I'm not just trying to help one group, I think that was the main part at first, that they thought, you know, in Woodlawn where we are, there are four main groups or cliques or gangs, whatever you want to call them. There's some other subsets, but four main ones. Once they realized that, hey, he's not just trying to help one group, he's trying to help all of us, then the trust came and they let down their, you know, they let down their barriers a little, and we started working slowly together and things started to change. But at first it was real touch and go.
you start, it's not just that they leave you alone. You just said you're working together. Like you're working with gangs, gang members. How does that work?
So, you know, we started off, and when we first started Project Hood, one of the first things that we did that was really big is that we did a truce. And I got all the gangs together to commit to not carrying out any violent acts against one another. That was really, really, really big. And I can remember the day that we got the truce and we had over 100 guys in the church from different gangs. And I can remember the tension and the anger and the hostility in that room, you know, because they were faced with the fact that, okay, sitting over there is a guy that killed my brother, sitting over there is a guy. So it was real tension filled. And so to get them to agree to a truce was really major. But I saw in that event how it was kind of like two bullies on a playground, and they really don't want to fight. They're just waiting for somebody to step in and say, okay, break it up. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I felt a lot of the actions going on in our community were that they were looking for somebody to step in and stop them. And that's basically what we did with Project Hood. And that's, I inserted myself into a situation to try to bring about peace. And we do that to this day. We work consistently with women and men who are in gangs or coming out of gangs to help get their lives on track. We have 15 full-time employees who have a full-time check, benefits, retirement, mm-hmm. everything. All of those individuals come from gang environments. All of those individuals come from those four groups that I told you about. And we train them in conflict resolution. We give them trauma counseling. We're training them in teamwork. We're training them in community responsibility and community change. And those individuals have been instrumental in helping us to recruit other individuals for our programs. And that's kind of how we've been able to master changing our community a little bit.
Yeah, it gives me chills. The work that you're doing is just so amazing. And I'm a small town girl like you, and I never really got out of the small town. So I'm totally ignorant to kind of the politics and the way that gangs work in the big cities. So you talked about these four groups that are like in your block. Are those the same like kind of four gangs that are running all the bad neighborhoods in Chicago, or does every block sort of have its different, like how far does your network go now throughout the Chicago area?
So you basically have in Chicago six, maybe seven major gangs. But out of those seven major gangs or eight major gangs, you have subgroups, which are blocks. So for instance, you may have a gang, the GDs, or in our neighborhood is GDs and BDs and Stones. Those, and the GDs may have six or seven blocks. They're different groups though. So under the GD umbrella, you got six subsets. Under the BD umbrella, you may have another six subsets. So you actually have 20 cliques. Instead of two gangs, you got 20 cliques. And that's one of the reasons why the violence is so hard to get a hold of in Chicago, because you have all of these cliques, all of these sub cliques, and they're a lot of times, sometimes they're calling their own shots and they're doing their own thing and they're not reporting to any hierarchy. Mm. Especially the younger they get, the more rebellious they are toward a hierarchy.
Is that, to your knowledge, is that kind of structure of main gangs with cliques, is that how it is in every city that has gang violence, or is that special to Chicago?
I think it's special toward Chicago. And one of the reasons being is that when in the 90s and early 20s, these gangs had structure. They had like a chief, they had boards, they had block leaders. They were set up like corporations. Mm-hmm. But what happened is the police, the feds arrested all the chiefs, all the boards, and a lot of them went to prison for lots of years, mm-hmm. 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. But when that happened, there was no more leadership, and there became a vacuum of people who just stepped up and put themselves in charge. And so instead of having one person in charge, now you got 10 persons mm-hmm. in charge. That became the clicks. That became the problem.
Oh my gosh. That is such a conundrum. So, so should that not be what police do? Like, if you're the head of a gang, like, you're a bad person, right? Who's done bad things and orchestrated bad things. But is it worse to take them out, you know, and put them in prison? And now, like you said, you have this kind of domino effect of other people who shouldn't be in leadership positions that are now. Is it just you can't, it's just a lose-lose situation? Like, if you're advising police, what do you think is the correct approach?
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's a losing situation. You have to abide by the law. No doubt about it. If individuals in your community are causing issues and causing problems and running gangs, hey, that has to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. We cannot allow illegal activities to be structured and organized. We just can't. Mm-hmm. But we also need to know, when you break up those structures and those organizations, that the crime is not going to stop unless you have something in place. And I think what may have happened is that they planned for that violence to pick up. I think they really believed, okay, we're going to arrest these heads. We're going to arrest these boards and chiefs, and the violence is going to decrease. I think the last thing they planned for was thinking, okay, these individuals are going to split our off now, and they're going to start commanding and demanding their own blocks. I don't think they planned for that. And I think that's what we're dealing with in Chicago now, how to fix that issue.
Do you have, I guess, does it happen pretty frequently that your church, I mean, you talked about your kind of your full-time employees and that they all came from kind of gang backgrounds. How frequently is that you're saving, that your church, people are like coming to Christ, coming to faith out of the gangs through your church's doors?
Oh, all the time. You know, you can come here and you're going to meet individuals whose lives have been drastically changed by the gospel and by the fact that they're working and they get everything that they need as far as the resources to change their lives around. And I think earlier when we were talking about seminary education, I think those are the type of things that helped me to formulate a theology that deals with the whole person, instead of just saying, you know, I just want to help people spiritually. No, I understand if you're going to be in this neighborhood, you have to help people spiritually. You have to help them with their families. You have to help them economically. You have to help them holistically in order for them to get their families back on track. And so I think that's what's helped formulate our whole ministry mindset.
Do you have I'm sure you have many, but do you have an example of a success story that you could share with our audience? Someone that came through the doors and like you've seen them completely do a 180 with their life. Maybe now they're even involved in Project Hood, or just an example of someone who's just was maybe the worst of the worst. And now there's someone you would leave alone with your grandchild.
I could give you so many stories, which is a great thing. But one of the stories I can tell you right off the bat that comes to mind is Alfred Creamer. His name is Al. They used to call him Big Al. And the reason why they called him Big Al is because he was one of the gang heads in the neighborhood from a building that was called the Calumet Building. Al went away to prison for 11 years as part of that group that I was telling you about that was arrested, and they sent them all to prison. And when Al came back, we were established in the neighborhood. We had started to really work to change things. And one of the guys that was on the case with him said, hey, I want to, you know, you got to go talk to Pastor Brooks now because the neighborhood is not the same. You got to go kind of, you know, check in. And he was like, I don't have to check in with anybody. I run this whole neighborhood. And so when he came and met me, we talked about how they destroyed the neighborhood, how they messed the neighborhood up, and how they need to be accountable to fix it. And at first, he was kind of taken back, you know, that a preacher would talk to him like that. But he finally started coming to the church. He finally started getting it. We hired him on to work with mentoring the boys who were getting sent to juvenile, and the juvenile system would send them back to us in a program to help them to stay out of jail. and we put him over that. And he started, we then eventually got him into construction school. We then eventually got him a job in construction. He works for a really nice company here in Chicago. He got married, and last year he bought his first home. Yeah, exactly. Yesterday he sent me a picture of him in Las Vegas, taking a picture with him and his wife and Magic Johnson. Whoa. And so, you know, so just Al is and if you meet him now, you would never know, okay, this guy was a drug dealer, this guy was gang banging, this guy was in the streets, this guy was running. You would never know because he's so humble and his life has been changed so dramatically.
That's what we like to hear. Do you have a lot of copycats now? Do you have a lot of pastors, preachers, churches trying to do the same thing that you're doing throughout Chicago or even other cities reaching out?
Yeah, we have a lot of people who call us all the time and who come by. There was just a pastor here earlier that they come. We had a pastor here this weekend from Columbia, Missouri. We're always having pastors to come by and try to figure out how we're doing it. We're in the process now of planning a conference eventually for churches and not-for-profits, because our goal is to go to other major cities that are having some of the same issues, like Philadelphia, St. Louis, New Orleans, Memphis, especially all of these places that are having issues like Chicago. We believe that we're creating a model for what works, and we want them to come. We want them to copy. You know, I tell people there's nothing wrong with copying if you copy in the right cat. So right. That's what it's all about. And so we want to help, and we want to give everyone all the tools that we could possibly give them to help them to help their cities and their neighborhoods.
Wonderful. So tell us about phase two of being a rooftop pastor. You told us about phase one. So, tell us about phase two.
Absolutely. I love to. So here we are. You know, we had this land. 10 years had gone by. We had a vision. We're going to build a center. We've been telling people we're going to build a center. We possess the land. We've cleared it out. The hotel is gone. But for 10 years, we've been telling the story. My son, who now works for us and who is the president of Project Hood, and then also Ryan, who grew up in the church. His mother was my church administrator. He went off to law school, worked in D.C., and came back. Those two started working for us and started to challenge me about the vision and basically said, hey, if you're going to keep sharing this vision, you got to get the building. And so they said, what's the plan? And I asked him, how much money do we have? You know, the building that we wanted to build at that time, we thought it was going to cost us $20 million. And they were like, sorry, but we don't have any money. We got a big vision, but no bank account. Mm-hmm. And so if the 10-year anniversary was coming up when I was on the roof the first time. And so I told them, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get 8 train containers. I'm going to build a deck on top of these 8 train containers. I'm going to put some tents up there, and I'm going to do it all over again. And we're going to raise the money to build the building. And everybody was like, no, 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 please don't do it. It's not going to work. But I was committed to doing it. And I thought, you know, it worked the first time. God blessed us. And this time we have social media. We have more people. Our audience is broader. We can do this. And so I thought, I'm going to commit myself to at least 94 days, 100 days to stay on this roof, and let's see what happens. And so after 100 days, we'd only raised about, not only because it's significant, we had raised about $1 million, but we were still a long way from where we wanted to be. And Fox Network started allowing me to do some stories called Rooftop Revelations, where I started talking about different issues in the city of Chicago and different issues that we were facing with across the country. And it started to be really appealing to a lot of their audience, which was amazing. And as a result, I ended up doing over 100 days of stories, and I ended up staying on the roof for 343 days. After that, we had 20,000 new donors, and we had raised $20 million in cash and pledges to start our building. But this also, during this time, the price of our building has raised significantly. Yeah. We're now, our building is costing, you know, $35 million. Wow. It's 90,000. Yeah, I know, right? It's 90,000 square feet, but it's going to be the beacon of hope on the south side of Chicago, not just for the south side of Chicago, but it's going to be an amazing place. When people see it, they're going to be amazed. When they come in, they're going to be amazed. and the life transformation that's going to take place is going to be amazing to people. So we really are creating a model that is going to be a fantastic testament to what can be done when you merge hope, accountability, self-responsibility, and get people motivated to want to do something different about a neighborhood, what can happen.
What all is in this community building? Like, is there a gym? Is there a pool? Like, what classrooms? Sure. What is it?
Yeah. So it's called the Robert R. McCormick Leadership and Economic Opportunity Center. It's named Robert R. McCormick because the McCormick Foundation here in Chicago bought the naming rights for $8 million. Part of this center, it's called Leadership and Economic Opportunity Center because it's not just a community center. We tell people if they can imagine an educational facility, a YMCA, a church, and a trade school all balled up in one and then shot with some steroids, that's what they have. So the center includes three restaurants, Wood Grain Pizza, the Burger Joint, Oberweis Ice Cream, where we're going to be teaching. We have a culinary arts kitchen, a community kitchen, where we can teach culinary arts and teach restaurant management. Wow. We have a Well Now Urgent Healthcare where people can come and get medical services. We have a trauma counseling facility where people can come who have been dealing with trauma in our neighborhood, who have not gotten the counseling that they may have needed for themselves or their families to help get them through the trauma that they've experienced in life. We have that type of facility. We also have a bank. Matter of fact, the bank presently is located inside our church in the lobby. It's a Wintrust Community Bank, which is one of the larger banks here in the city of Chicago. But they're going to be moving that bank across the street to the center. And so it's going to be have a full financial institution. It's also going to have a trade school where we're teaching construction trades, the carpentry, electrical, plumbing, and automotive. We have a STEM and computer science space. We have a youth facility space. We have, if you ask the kids in the neighborhood, what's the most exciting thing that you want about the center? They all hands down say the swimming pool. So we have an Olympic-sized swimming pool being built, and that's all on the first floor. And then on the second floor, we have a theater that's state of the arts. We have a music and TV production studio where kids can learn how to do production and do music and TV and editing and all of that stuff. We have a golf simulation room where we can teach golfing, where we're going to teach kids how to golf and how to be caddies. Because in our neighborhood, the golf course is being rebuilt because it's by the Obama Center. And so we want to give our kids an opportunity to go over there to be caddies, to learn how to network with individuals that they may have never had the opportunity to network with and make money to take care of themselves and to go to school. And so we're really excited about the golf simulation room. And then we have two full courts, basketball courts. We have a full workout facility. And in the workout facility is an exercise room, a dance studio, and a boxing gym. On top of all of that is a roof deck where we have a rooftop garden, rooftop community space where we can have meetings, and a greenhouse. So it's 90,000 square feet. And it is going to be fantastic.
So you're currently building right now?
Yes. Right now, we're currently building across the street. They are building and...
Oh, yeah, there it is. He's showing me.
Yeah, across the street, they're building and they're working on the second floor now. And so we're really excited. We're still... our goal is to build it debt-free. So we're still raising money. We have about... 8 more million to go that we need to raise to be able to be debt free, but we're working really hard to do that, and it's going to be an awesome place, and our community really needs it. As I said before, you know, they call this block O Block, named after that young man named O.D. Perry. We decided to keep the O in the name, but we call it Opportunity Block. Yay. So this building is about us creating opportunities to help people to change their lives.
Is there any kind of security concerns? You know, I don't know what kind of, you've cleaned up the neighborhood a lot, but will that be an issue, you know, vandalism or something like that happening to the building?
Yeah, you know, safety and security are always a must. You can't have a place that is transformational in our community if it's not safe. So unfortunately, we're going to make sure that camera surveillance is everywhere. We're going to make sure that we also have on-hand security, armed security, because we do have a bank, we do have restaurants, and so we want to make sure that people feel safe. We're hoping that the Chicago Police Department is going to have a little office space inside the center so that some of the officers, when they need a place to stop and go use the bathroom, they have their own little place they can take breaks. And so because we want to make sure that everybody understands that this is a community space and that we want it to stay safe. And I really think that it's so beautiful. The look is so beautiful that it's really going to help to change the mindsets of individuals in the neighborhood to understand that this is our building and we're not going to destroy it. We're not going to deface it. We're not going to break the glass. We're going to work really hard to make sure that it stays a beautiful facility.
Okay. And Chicago gets used as kind of a political football. People are always pointing to Chicago, all, you know, Republicans, Democrats, conservative, you know, you probably, well, I don't know, maybe it helps your cause. Maybe you're sick of it. You're kind of like, leave us alone and let us solve our problems. I don't know. But what does everyone get wrong about Chicago?
I think one of the things that people get wrong about Chicago is that they believe that there are not individuals who are trying to change Chicago, who are working really, really hard. And I think that they forget that there are some beautiful, beautiful places in the city because the violence gets talked about so much. But Chicago is a beautiful city. There's nothing like the lake, and there's nothing like Lakeshore Drive and downtown. And but we do have to work on the violence. We do have to work on issues. But there are people in Chicago who are working really hard, like our organization, to make sure that we change the mindset and the mentality of the people who live here.
Yeah, to that point, I've seen people say, well, you know, I want to help Chicago, but they just keep voting in the same types of people, or they won't, you know, it's up to them to vote in the leadership that they want to see, you know, in order to make these changes. What's your response to people who say stuff like that?
Sure. I think, you know, there's a little validity to it that oftentimes we keep voting in the same people who keep causing us the same issues and the same problems. That is an issue. But I tell people at the same time, you can vote whoever you want in office. They're not going to solve our problems and solve all of our issues. And I think anyone who waits on government to come in to save the day is only shooting themselves in the foot. It's not going to happen. Superman is not coming to save the day. And so we can't continue that idea that somehow if we just vote the right person in that everything is going to change. No, everything is not going to change. It's still going to require us to roll our sleeves up. It's still going to require us to put principles in place that will help people to change their lives. It's still going to require us to teach people about self-responsibility, financial accountability. It's going to require a lot of work, regardless of who's in office. And so people need to understand that. So when it comes to Chicago, when it comes to this block, we're not waiting on the mayor. We're not waiting on the governor. We're going to roll our sleeves up. We're going to take, for lack of better words, the bull by the horns, and we're going to go at it, and we're going to change this neighborhood.
Do you, so, you know, in the circles that I run around in, which is, I'm at Free Black Thought, right? So I'm with people that they say, let's be a victor, not a victim. Like, let's not rely on the government. You know, I run around with a lot of Black people that think like that, but that's not always the norm. So what I'm getting at is the circles that I run in, you're very beloved. Everybody knows who Pastor Corey Brooks is. They know your project. Everybody supports you 100%. But I'm wondering, is that the same? Is that always your reception on the ground? Do people say, oh, you're a sellout, or you're an Uncle Tom, or you're too conservative, or how dare you say the government shouldn't solve our problems? What's sort of the on the ground feedback you get?
So it's you're right from one standpoint. There are certain elites in Chicago, certain politicians in Chicago who would call me a sellout or who would call me an Uncle Tom because they want to keep things the way they are to benefit themselves. But when you get to the people on the ground, especially in our neighborhood, they'll be the first to tell you, listen, I don't care if Pastor Brooks is a Republican. I don't care if Pastor Brooks is a conservative. All we know is Pastor Brooks loves the community. Pastor Brooks loves the guys who are in gangs. Pastor Brooks is trying his hardest to change it. And they see the actions. And so a lot of these individuals who talk about me, who say things about me, when you look at their portfolio, they're not doing anything. So I get my idea and mindset is keep my head down, stay clean and work. And no one is going to outwork me. Nobody is going to do more for the people in my community than me. And I think that is what changes people's opinions of you. Not just you talking about it, but you got to really put some action. And so I focus on just action, 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 action. And I try to tune out all the negative stuff that people say.
And, you know, people who are listening to this who are inspired, of course, you're still fundraising. And I mean, even if you're still fundraising for your building, but even if you weren't, I mean, Project Hood is a not-for-profit that's going to need funding so people can make donations there and stuff. What are some other organizations or individuals, people, groups that are doing good work in Chicago that you would also recommend people check out who are ignoring the noise and just doing the work, as you say?
There's some good groups. There's a group called The Dream, Dion's Dream. You know, he is doing a phenomenal job as far as trying to help with food scarcity. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of non-healthy places in Chicago on the South Side where food is concerned. And so he's trying to fill the area of making sure that kids have fruits and vegetables and families have good food. And he's doing a phenomenal job. And so I appreciate the work that he does. There's another organization. They're not as conservative as I am and as we are, but they do a great job in their area of helping people with the resources that they need, called Bright Star. They do a great job. And then Metropolitan Family Services, who is another group that we're connected to, that helps facilitate getting a lot of individuals the services that they need to help their families change around. So there are some great organizations in the city of Chicago. Hope Academy is a great school that I would recommend to anyone who has a child getting ready to go to high school and they don't want them to go to a public school, but they want them to go to a nice Christian private school. It's a great school.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, we'll certainly link to all those groups in our show notes too, so people can check that out. I think we're at a good place to kind of segue into our speed round questions and then give you your final thoughts after
all
that.
Right.
These are 10 questions. There's no right or wrong answer. It's really just for fun. You try to get through them quickly, but you know, we'll go where the conversation takes us. Are you ready, Pastor Brooks?
Okay, let's see. I'm ready. 10 questions. Let's go.
Okay, question number one. What is the wildest conspiracy theory you low-key believe is true?
The wildest conspiracy theory that I low-key believe is true is that elections are fixed.
Mm. Do you think you could kill a person in self-defense?
Yes.
Is the word Negro a slur?
Yes, but I've been guilty of using it plenty of times.
What are your thoughts on white people having dreadlocks?
Oh, it's cool. You know, I think to each his own. I love people should wear the hair that they desire to wear. You know, I wish I could wear dreads.
Is there a difference between being happy and being joyful?
Yeah, joyful is happy is something that you can turn off and on. Joyful is more of an internal state that I believe that is locked into who you are in Christ. And so joy is something that no one can take away from me.
What is the worst part of being black?
The worst part of being black. Oh, being told that you cannot achieve something because of the color of your skin, because of where you're from, or because of where you come from. That is the worst.
What is the best part of being black?
The best part of being black is knowing that you come from a long lineage of people who have survived some of the most toughest of circumstances, whether it's coming across the ocean in slave ships or enduring hard times of slavery Jim Crow laws, all of that stuff, knowing that you come from individuals who endured that makes you feel like an overcomer, I believe.
Are the best things in life really free?
Yes. You know, the fact that I can wake up every morning and breathe and not have to pay for oxygen. Amen.
Does pineapple go on pizza?
Absolutely not. I'm sure if you're in Hawaii, they would argue with you. But in Chicago, we don't eat pineapple on pizza unless you are someone who moved to the city. But real Chicagoans, nah.
Okay. And question number 10, final question. What's a movie that you like that everyone else hated? Got bad audience reviews.
A bad audience review. I just watched this movie and I was surprised that it didn't have a lot of great reviews, but it wasn't listed as a bad movie, but it wasn't listed as a great movie either. But it's called Burial with Jamie Foxx.
Okay.
And I watched it on a plane and it was so good. And it was about this guy, Willie Garrick, who was an attorney, a big time attorney, who helped to take down the Loewen Group, said they were trying to buy up all of the burial places around the country and overcharge people. Mm-hmm. And so this little bitty funeral home director in Mississippi, a white guy, took them on. And Willie Garrick, his black lawyer, was his lawyer, and they won the case. But in the middle of all of that, it dealt with racial issues and things like that. And it was really, really good.
I haven't even heard of that movie. So now I'm going to look it up. Is it older or new?
You must go watch it. It's new. It's Jamie Foxx. You have to watch it. It is so good. And just the way they played the racial stuff with Mississippi and Willie Garrick being a black attorney, a big time. It was just really, really good.
All right. Well, that's definitely going on the list now, on my list. Okay, Pastor Brooks, thank you so much for the interview, for the time, for the work that you do, for the difference that you make. Do you have any final thoughts, things you want to leave our audience with?
I just want to say thank you. And I want to say thank you to Free Black Thought. And I want to continue to ask people, you know, don't let people put you in a category to where you're not free to think the way you desire to think. You know, you don't have to be restrained. You don't have to be held into some box. The fact that we are black does not mean that we all have to think the same way. And I thank God for the liberty and the freedom to be able to think as a free black man. So I hope others will do the same.
Amen. Well, thank you so much. We will stay in touch. Right. Reach out to us when you have another, you know, when you're on the rooftop again, you know, give us a line first so we can help promote that.
Absolutely.
We love to watch you work. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you so much.